Good evening, I'm Benjamin Dolly. Welcome to WCVE Forum. Tonight, we hear Speaker David Gartenstein-Ross, Director of the Center for the Study of Terrorist Radicalization, speaking on the subject of Somalia, America's Forgotten Battleground. His speech to the World Affairs Council of Greater Richmond was recorded on February 29th.
As I was preparing this speech, the major question I grappled with is, why should Americans care about Somalia? You know, it's half a world away, very different from the United States culturally, geographically, in almost every way. And most Americans relate to Somalia primarily through a single movie, Black Hawk Down, which to us defines what Somalia is, and in fact was used in briefings for policymakers in Washington, D.C. for quite some time. Actually, the movie does a remarkable job of depicting the Battle of Mogadishu, where three American Black Hawk helicopters were shot down, 18 American soldiers, along with over 1,000 Somalis, were killed in this incident. And one interesting footnote to Black Hawk Down is it actually provided us, perhaps, a little taste of the next major conflict that was to come. Now, historians find it to be very controversial whether or not Al-Qaeda was a part of that incident. I'm going to get into that in a second. But I will say that certainly Al-Qaeda's perception was that this was the first time they bloodied the U.S.'s nose. For those who haven't watched this movie, to give a quick bit of background, there was a humanitarian mission in the Horn of Africa, Somalia specifically, called Operation Restore Hope. The situation there, the humanitarian situation as it is now, was terrible then. You had a government that had just collapsed. Over 300,000 Somalis died due to drought, due to civil war and fighting that came after the collapse of the government. And since then, you know, the country has still lacked a government in anything but name. Peter Bergen, a very esteemed terrorism analyst, wrote in the book that first made his reputation, Holy War, Inc., about this situation. And this is the only block quote I will have in my entire speech, but I thought it was worth outlining. Bergen writes, in 1993, one of bin Laden's military commanders, Abu Hafs, traveled to Somalia to determine how best to attack U.S. forces, reporting back to bin Laden in Sudan. That is, they perceived the U.S.'s force as being an invasion force. They were looking to how to repel it. An Al-Qaeda mortar specialist was also dispatched to the country. By early 1993, Abu Hafs was providing military training and assistance to Somalis. On October 3rd and 4th, 1993, 18 American soldiers were killed in an intense firefight in Mogadishu on a mission to try to snatch General Idaid, who was preventing food aid from reaching its intended recipients. During the battle, rocket-propelled grenades downed three American Black Hawk helicopters. A U.S. official told me that the skills involved in shooting down these helicopters were not the skills that the Somalis could have learned on their own. In the definitive account of the Mogadishu battle, Black Hawk Down, the journalist Mark Bowden reports that Idaid's men were indeed trained by Arabs who had fought against the Soviets in Afghanistan and who taught the Somalis that the most effective way to shoot down a helicopter with an RPG was to hit the vulnerable tail rotor. It's Peter Bergen writing in 2001, looking back at the Black Hawk Down incident and providing data points that suggest that Al-Qaeda may have been involved. Now, I should say, this is controversial among analysts and historians. Whether Al-Qaeda, you know, it's uncontroversial that Al-Qaeda trainers were in Mogadishu prior to the Battle of Mogadishu and that they provided training to some of the forces. Where analysts differ is, was there actually a connection between those Al-Qaeda trainers and the Black Hawk Down incident? I'm not here to tell you what the answer is, but what I will say is that in Al-Qaeda's perception, this was the first time they bloodied the U.S.'s nose, and Osama bin Laden would refer to this in his propaganda on multiple occasions. So up front, you know, we start with this battle, and I want to give you a few themes that are going to pervade the speech as we look at why Somalia matters and how that country has reached the situation it's in now, and how the U.S. has either made things better or else contributed to the woes. A few different themes that will pervade the speech. One is a broad issue, which is concern about ungoverned spaces where terrorist groups can find safe haven, and how difficult it is to actually address this problem. This is something that since the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. has seen as a top concern. After all, you know, Afghanistan was half a world away also, an absolute backwater, but one where a terrorist group was able to communicate, train, plan an attack that ultimately had a major effect on our way of life. Second theme is going to be the increasing need for any U.S. operations, whether it's military, humanitarian, to understand history and to understand culture. Indeed, one thing that was very much overlooked over the course of the past 6-7 years is how one specific U.S. policy towards Somalia ended up basically walking right into a major area of sensitivity and a major historical conflict as perceived by the Somalis. Third theme is the great potential in all of our actions for unintended consequences, something that should be a very strong lesson when we look at other areas where we have considered or are considering action, places like Libya, Syria, and elsewhere. And finally, the intersection of security and humanitarian concerns. So with that in mind, the current group that the U.S. is most concerned about in Somalia is called, as the introduction said, Al-Shabaab. It means the youth in Arabic. This is a militant group that split from other Islamist groups that just within the past couple of weeks announced an official merger with the overall Al-Qaeda organization. It controls a broad swath of territory still in southern Somalia, and this speech will examine that group's evolution and how it's been affected by outside forces. So to begin with, let's look historically at Islamism within Somalia. And what I mean by Islamism is the desire to implement religious law through the state, as opposed to seeing religion as more of a personal code of conduct and ethics. Historically, if you look at the practice of Islam, the religion, not Islamism within Somalia, you'll find a very moderate practice, in some ways syncretistic, mixing in with more historical practices of faith, as well as being suffused with a kind of mysticism that we know in the West as Sufism. There's a few notable exceptions, though, to this rather moderate religious legacy. One is an individual named Ahmed Gran, which in Somali means Ahmed the Left-Handed, who lived in the 16th century, from 1506 to 1543. He ended up leading a jihad against the Ethiopians, penetrating to the heart of Ethiopia, where he executed several massacres. This rivalry between the Somalis, a Muslim people, and the Ethiopians, a Christian people, is one that would dominate both people's perceptions of each other and both people's perceptions of where threats emanated from. Both countries, in fact, would reach out to colonial powers to help them. In the case of the Somalis, they would reach out to Muslim powers, and in the case of the Ethiopians, they'd reach out to European Christian powers, in particular reaching out to the Portuguese at the time for assistance. The other major figure that's a deviation from this rather moderate historical legacy is named Mohammed Abdullah Hassan, known to the British as the Mad Mullah. He lived in the early 20th century, and as the great historian of Somalia, I.M. Lewis, recounts, Hassan taught and preached, denouncing smoking, denouncing the chewing of the stimulant cot plant, and generally condemning all excessive indulgence and luxury, and exhorting his countrymen to return to the strict path of Muslim devotion. So a very early 20th century example of Islamism in action. But also, dominating his view was a response to colonialism. He opposed the colonialism of the British at the time, although actually had the exact opposite effect of intended, of that which he intended. Rather than pushing the British away, he actually caused a rather small British outpost to become far, far bigger and to expand in response to his attacks. He also opposed the colonialism of Ethiopia, thus showing that the historical legacy that goes all the way back to the 16th century remained into the 20th. Now, Shabaab, moving to where we are now, is the latest incarnation of various Islamist groups in Somalia. The Islamism, you know, the practice of the faith that tries to implement it at the state level, had been suppressed under Somalia's ruler, General Siad Barre, who had executed a military coup in 1969 and ruled Somalia until the early 1990s. On the first anniversary of his coup, we're going back to 1970, General Siad had said that Somalia would be governed by what he called scientific socialism, or to translate from Somali, wealth sharing based on wisdom. He claimed that, in contrast to some other socialist regimes that were explicitly atheistic in nature, Siad claimed that his socialist regime was compatible with the tenets of Islam, that essentially this socialist rule was expressing the communal spirit of Islam. Siad would be the last ruler of Somalia who would have a writ that actually encompassed the entire state. He focused on one other thing that would prove to be very, very important later, which is stamping out the clans. There's always been in Somali history this tension between ethnic identity and national identity. Somalia has a very strong clan-based system, which, you know, if you're trying to get a nation state that can be successfully ruled, you can't have subnational identity interfering. Prior to General Siad, the governments were also concentrating on stamping out clans. They made people, for example, rather than referring to their clan affiliation, refer to their ex, that is their ex-affiliation, what their ex-clan was. Siad actually banned people from using the circumlocution of ex, which made I.M. Lewis, for example, when he visited Somalia, playfully ask the apparatchiks who were shepherding him around whether he could ask about somebody's ex-ex, their ex-ex-clan. He noted that the apparatchiks did not find this bit of humor very funny. But under Siad, you had a dictatorship emerge and a cult of personality. He had a list of enemies of the state, and near the top of the list was rumor mongers. As I.M. Lewis notes, personal authority of the kind that Siad had wielded had usually only successfully in Somalia's history been wielded by national religious heroes. At one point, showing how he reacted to religious expressions, you had 10 Islamic scholars protest changes to family law within Somalia, changes that were designed to elevate the status of women. In response, he had those scholars executed and also generally rounded up religious individuals, religious figures, who were opposed to these changes. Now, the first modern Islamist group, as opposed to just expressions of the desire to implement religion at the state level, the first Islamist group was called Al-Ittihad Al-Islamiyya, the Islamic Union. It was formed around 1983. It had a couple of goals at its founding. One was to defeat Siad Barre's regime and to replace it with an Islamic state rather than the secular state that existed. And the second goal was to unify what it regarded as Greater Somalia. The notion of Greater Somalia is one that has, in many ways, shaped Somali perceptions. You have large majority Somali areas in places like Ethiopia's Ogaden province, northeastern Kenya, and also in Djibouti. And in the Somali perception reflected by the idea of Greater Somalia, this is rightfully Somali land. In many places in Africa, the Middle East, and elsewhere, where you have borders that ultimately ended up being settled in the wake of the colonial powers there, you have land disputes such as this because current borders don't very well reflect where natural ethno-national boundaries lie. Siad Barre ended up being weakened in the late 1980s. May 1986, he suffered a near-fatal car crash. He was injured and flown to Saudi Arabia to recover. His senior vice president, General Mohammed Ali Samatar, oversaw a caretaker government, and though he didn't attempt a coup while Barre was out of the country, this weakened Barre because people within his clan and others were asking, you know, what happens when Barre finally exits the scene. They were looking past his governance. Now, his government consistently weakened until Mogadishu, kind of like it is now, was seen as being no more than the government of a city. Further, you had his government additionally weakened when Western human rights activists pressured their governments to cut off aid to Siad Barre, which ended up happening. Barre had to flee the country. Now, the country devolved into anarchy. You had the Black Hawk Down scenario. But meanwhile, something else was happening within Somalia. It wasn't just this failed humanitarian mission, but also Al-Ittihad Al-Islamiyya, the group I mentioned before, tried to seize targets of opportunity throughout Somalia. They held the seaports of Kismayo and Mirka for almost a year. In areas that they were able to control, they implemented a strict version of Islamic law, Sharia law. But the area that they controlled for the longest period was called Luk. It's a small town which borders Ethiopia and Kenya. It's close to something I mentioned before, the Ogaden region of Ethiopia, an area that is majority Somali, something that ultimately ended up being given to Ethiopia rather than Somalia in the wake of the Second World War and has remained a point of dispute between the two countries, actually leading to a war between them in the late 1970s. Now, Al-Ittihad controlled Luq for a sustained period and carried out a number of attacks into Ethiopia. There were assassinations, bombings, going as far as the Ethiopian capital of Addis. In response, Ethiopia invaded this portion of Somalia, completely uprooted Al-Ittihad from Luq, and thereafter, Al-Ittihad was regarded as a spent force. Then, of course, you had the 9/11 attacks. There was concern that Somalia could be used as a safe haven by terrorists. The U.S. Was looking at potential areas, you know, ungoverned spaces, such as Afghanistan, where you could have a major terrorist stronghold emerge. Somalia was thought to be one. You had a rather bungled attempt by the U.S. to support factions of warlords who claimed to be against terrorism. And in the wake of their failure, we actually saw a new incarnation of the Islamic of Al-Ittihad al-Islamiyah emerge. It was called the Islamic Courts Union. Originally, they were a confederation of loosely related Islamic courts that would provide some sort of semblance of justice in areas that they controlled. Now, the justice that they provided was certainly, from our perspective, both rough and brutal. But to some people, was very much preferable to the anarchic conditions that prevailed. One comparison that I think is made, and there are limits to this comparison, but is the Taliban in Afghanistan. You know, the Taliban also emerged under anarchic conditions, and there's a number of founding myths to the Taliban. By founding myths, I mean things that might not be true. They get repeated enough. They might not be true, but they give us some indication as to what it stood for and why it found some adherents. One of these founding myths is there were a couple of women. They were kidnapped by the soldiers who fought for two warlords. Their heads were shaved. They were being raped repeatedly by the warlord's men. And in response, Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, ended up gathering men together. They went into the camp. They freed the women. And then they promptly hanged both warlords from the barrels of their tank. Now, this gives us, for Afghanistan, an example of what the Taliban stood for. You had a collapse of government. The weakest members of society, young ladies, were being preyed upon. Moral standards had collapsed. And in response to this, the Taliban stood for justice. Now, it's a rough justice. The warlords received no trial. They were instead summarily hanged. But it was justice nonetheless, preferable to anarchy. Likewise, with the Islamic courts, there's two sides to it. You know, on the one hand, their extension can be seen as preferable to anarchy, and it was by many people. On the other hand, as with the Taliban, there also are definitive problems. You know, the Taliban in Afghanistan reduced women to second or third class status within the country, highly problematic. The Islamic courts also imposed very strict separation of the sexes, at one point arresting a karate instructor for having female students. Like the Taliban, clamped down on forms of light entertainment, arresting people for watching movies, shooting and killing people for trying to watch the World Cup. So you have two sides to what they stood for. At the end of the day, though, there was one major concern that the U.S. had, and that was security. The Islamic courts were gaining ground within Somalia in 2006. At the beginning of June of 2006, they took Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia. Thereafter, had a rapid series of gains throughout the country, taking key port cities such as Kismayo, taking transit cities. By October 2006, they controlled most of southern Somalia's strategic points, could move supplies from south to north, and had encircled the UN-recognized government, what's called the Transitional Federal Government, which was hunkered down in a south-central Somali city called Baidoa. Then, in December 2006, based on concerns that both the U.S. and Ethiopia shared, Ethiopia ended up intervening in Somalia, something that the U.S. supported both financially, with intelligence, and through other means. Now, things have not gone well since. Insurgency broke out. Shabab has ended up capturing a broad swath of southern Somalia, and a major drought descending into famine in areas that Shabab controlled ended up rocking the Horn of Africa late last year. So as we get into this more recent history, there's one question I want to address, which is, were U.S. concerns simply wrong? As I said, this intervention on the Ethiopians' part did not go well. for a variety of reasons, which we'll get into. And so you've had a number of commentators who've had a revisionist take on the Islamic courts, describing them as a relatively moderate institution. I think that the problems with the invasion don't prove the moderation of the Islamic courts. Briefly, I do think that American analysts had legitimate concerns. For example, you had known al-Qaeda operatives serving as leaders within the Islamic courts. One, for example, was Aidan Hashi Iroh, who served as basically the right-hand man to Sheikh Hassan Dahir Aweis, who headed the consultative committee of the Islamic courts. You had terrorist training camps in Somalia. About 17 of them existed during the height of the Islamic courts. In fact, at one point, you had a very embarrassing moment for Sheikh Yusuf Indo Ade, who was one of the Islamic courts leaders, someone who has since then flipped to the pro-government side. But there were rumors that foreign fighters, that is, people from places like Pakistan, the Arab states, had come to Somalia to train. Indo Ade gave a public statement in which he said, there are no foreign terrorists in Somalia, never. Within a week of giving that statement, the Associated Press actually unearthed a tape of Indo Ade himself at a camp in Somalia with foreigners, thus very much undermining his denial. You had Arabic language propaganda tapes for the Islamic courts that As-Sahab, a media outlet that's affiliated with al-Qaeda, helped to produce, as well as rhetorical nods going back and forth between the two. All of this created, I believe, reasonable apprehension on the part of American analysts. But the fact that there are reasonable apprehensions doesn't mean that you have to do something and do it right now. Ultimately, the course we ended up taking has been very problematic. One of the themes that I've put forward for the past 500 years of the Horn of Africa history is this competition between Ethiopia and Somalia. Now, Ethiopia was seen as a natural vehicle for any sort of response to the rise of the Islamic courts. After all, they had this experience with Al-Ittihad, the predecessor organization, capturing Luke and attacking into Ethiopia. But Ethiopia being chosen as a vehicle was very problematic because of this historical sensitivity, this historical sense of rivalry. This is another power representing a different faith, which has been at odds and at war with the people of Somalia for quite some time. In fact, the only time Somalia has really unified as a country, that is where national identity took precedence over this sub-state identity, this clan identity, has been when it united against outside actors. It did so under Ahmed Gran in the 16th century. It did so under Muhammad Abdullah Hassan. But other than that, until the 21st century, Somalia has had a lot of trouble unifying its population. And even the unification we've seen here against outside invasion has been a very temporary unification that is not going to last. Shabab emerged as a distinct force during this invasion. The invasion of the Ethiopians, not surprisingly, ended up producing an insurgency-type situation, something that was foreseen by groups that looked into this. For example, the UN monitoring group on Somalia had said that the Islamic courts were capable of turning Somalia into an Iraq-type scenario, a prediction that proved to be absolutely correct. You also had a bit of a proxy war going on. Ethiopia has another enemy, that being Eritrea. And as Ethiopia went in, Eritrea ended up providing a great deal of support for the insurgency. In fact, it invited the insurgency into its capital of Asmara for a resistance conference. Now, Shabab, which had previously been seen as a militant wing of the Islamic courts, boycotted that conference. And the reasons provided, actually by an American spokesman, a man named Omar Hamami, who grew up in Alabama, the reasons provided in a January 2008 tape were threefold. One was they saw the need to implement Sharia. They distinguished Shabab from the Alliance for Reliberation of Somalia, what the umbrella name for the rest of the resistance in that way. They said that infidel powers like Eritrea would ultimately corrupt this zeal for Islamic law. A second reason is that they said they had a global perspective, that the other insurgent factions had basically a vision that was confined to the colonial borders of Somalia, while they wanted to implement a caliphate. And the third area in which they distinguished themselves from the other insurgent factions was religious methodology. Omar Hamami, in this statement, said that their religious methodology, their manhaj, was the same repeatedly heard from the mouth of the Mujahid Sheikh Osama bin Laden, the Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, and the hero Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, very explicitly aligning Shabab with al-Qaeda in methodology. This is something that would prove to be quite accurate when 4 years later the two would officially align, something which has now happened. Shabab became the dominant insurgent faction as a number of the other factions within the Islamic courts were folded into the transitional government in the hopes that this would create some semblance of peace. Now, eventually, Ethiopia withdrew. It left behind some African Union forces that basically were confined to the Mogadishu area. Meanwhile, Shabab came to control much of southern Somalia. As with the Islamic courts, it implemented a strict version of Islamic law in the areas it controlled. Now, for a while, with this situation gone awry, it seemed that the U.S. did not have a strategy. Last year, in particular in the wake of the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, a U.S. strategy for Somalia has become far clearer. There seem to be four prongs to what the U.S. is doing now. One is trying to implement a counterinsurgency-type strategy using AMISOM forces. That's the African Union mission to Somalia. These forces have cleared Shabab out of Mogadishu. They've expanded their writ somewhat beyond. Second, there's an effort to bolster non-state forces that can counter Shabab. One of those groups that has been used, known as Ahl al-Sunnah wal-Jama'ah, is a Sufi-oriented group that has a very different religious outlook than Shabab does. A third thing has been decapitation strikes aimed at Shabab leadership, the drones program that we hear so much about. That has been extended into Somalia. And a fourth is building up indigenous intelligence capabilities, such as the Somali National Security Agency. Now, the major problem we face in Somalia is governance. That at the end of the day, you can make all the military progress in the world, but if something isn't able to replace what's been there before, how sustainable is any progress? The transitional federal government has shown itself to be quite corrupt and to have very little ability to actually give people what they need to administer justice, to administer social services, to administer any semblance of governance. More recently, you've had outside powers other than the African Union forces again go in. After several kidnappings executed by Shabab in Kenya, you had Kenya go in militarily. This, in fact, may have been Shabab's intent in carrying out those kidnappings. After all, last year saw a number of defeats for Shabab, which I will outline in just a second, but mainly coming on humanitarian grounds. And kidnapping some people in Ethiopia and forcing this Christian power to go in is something that could again be used as a rallying cry, the same way that in 2006 to 2007, Ethiopia's presence was used as a rallying cry. Even Ethiopia went back in temporarily within the past few months to push Shabab back. Now, as I said, things over the past year hadn't gone particularly well for Shabab. And that's where we get into one last theme that I outlined in this presentation, which is the intersection between humanitarian and security concerns. Last year, the Horn of Africa was racked by what seems to have been its worst drought in 60 years. Tremendous humanitarian consequences. The Horn basically faced what you could call the perfect storm. Inadequate rainfall, global rise in food prices, a surging population, declining natural resources. Thus, about 10 million people were placed in need, urgent humanitarian need. The problem was compounded by the fact that some of the hardest hit areas in Somalia were controlled by Shabab. Now, basically, these could be seen as ground zero of the drought. The reason why this is problematic is because Shabab, in executing its control, kicked out Western humanitarian agencies, accusing them of spreading secularism and Christianity, a claim that is somewhat contradictory, but that was the claim nonetheless. You had a second thing. It's problematic not only from humanitarian consequences, but it actually, something that was seen as somewhat of a positive by analysts, also created a problem for Shabab, in that Shabab's legitimacy rested on the idea that it was better than the transitional federal government, you know, that it could provide services, it could provide justice, where the transitional government could not. If the areas that it's administering are the areas where famine exists, while the others merely have drought, That's something which really gives lie to Shabab's claim. So you had this problem for Western governments looking at this, the conflict between humanitarian ends and security ends. Essentially, one of the goals of Western governments was to keep money out of Shabab's hands. This is something that the U.S. has put the force of law behind. And humanitarian aid going back into Somalia would ultimately put some money back in Shabab's hands. For example, beginning in 2009, Shabab insisted that UN agencies and non-governmental organizations working in their areas should pay a $20,000 tax every 6 months. In areas where food aid went, Shabab sought to extract maximum gain from this food aid. For example, either taxing contractors going in or ensuring that there are contractors who already were pro-Shabab. The U.S. pledged ultimately about $5 million to assist Somalis who'd been struck by the drought, but it faced the problem of what do you do with the fact that the delivery of the aid would end up going to a specially designated global terrorist entity. This set up a real dilemma for American policymakers. Ambassador David Shin, who previously served as the ambassador to Ethiopia, talked with me late last year. What he said to me is that the U.S. has been a leader in saying we won't put up with money going to Shabab, but it creates a drastic humanitarian issue. Do you cut off food aid to a region because it will be indirectly funding a terrorist organization, he asked. Some humanitarians say that you have to hold your nose and do it. Others say that you shouldn't. Somalia, overall, is not going to go away as a problem set, nor will these competing interests, humanitarian interests and security interests, end up going away as a problem set that the U.S. will face. In fact, we're likely to see increasing problems that look quite a bit like this. Governing capacity is declining in many parts of the world. Somalia is the most extreme example in the world today, but you've seen a decline in various governments' ability to govern for a variety of reasons. The increasing expense of life, resource shortages, food price crises are part of the example of that. The age of austerity we're entering is also something which is going to contribute directly to that, because ultimately, when budgets need to be cut by Western countries, one of the things that's going to be on the chopping block is foreign aid, at least to be reduced. You have this coming at a time when also you have non-state actors who are empowered by technological advances, non-state actors who are able to fundamentally compete with nation states or out-compete nation states. So this is a problem set that, at least over the next decade, is almost certainly going to increase. Somalia ultimately is a tragedy. The consequences of the situation that Somalia faces are consequences we'll have to grapple with for some time to come. There's lessons here for the future of warfare. There's lessons here for the future of humanitarian problems, and there's lessons here in terms of how we approach problems like this moving forward. Ultimately, we'll have to deal with the legacy of Somalia, but in the future, I guarantee we will see other Somalia-type situations, and that's something that U.S. policymakers will be forced to deal with.
Thank you very much. I'd like to ask that anybody who would like to ask a question go to the microphone in the center. Yes, sir.
Thank you for the great talk. I'm curious as to how far the reach of problems caused by al-Shabaab may reach. And the United States is currently investing a tremendous amount of money in trying to make South Sudan actually work. Are there problems there caused by al-Shabaab, or how far could they cause us problems?
Shabaab has shown its reach in a few areas. It's been able to carry out kidnappings inside of Kenya. It was able to execute bombings in Uganda. It did this during the World Cup back in 2010, in part because Uganda has been one of the countries that has provided troops to the African Union mission in Somalia. The other thing which gives Western countries a real concern is basically what is sometimes referred to as the case of the disappearing Somalis. Essentially, you have a number of Somalis, and when I say a number, it's a relatively low number, but for each of these countries, it's in the dozens. You have a number of Somalis from the diaspora who disappeared. And the reason why is because they've gone back to Somalia to join up with militant groups there. In the U.S., the numbers put at about 40, primarily from the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, which has the largest population of Somalis in the United States, but other areas are represented as well. You have Somalis who've disappeared in Canada. This has been a recent thing where you've had prosecutions based upon this. The same thing in Sweden, in Australia. And the concern from Western analysts is that this could increase Shabaab's ability to project power. I think that overall that's the biggest concern. Now, as to South Sudan, yeah, that's obviously a possibility. South Sudan will almost certainly be a major flashpoint when we're looking at jihadism or Islamic-inspired terrorism in the future. But so far, Shabaab's capabilities have been much more potential rather than, at this point, actualized, with one exception, that being combat on the ground. I mean, they're very much engaged in combat against, you know, African Union forces, Ethiopian forces, and other forces. And this has included the accoutrements of insurgency, including suicide bombings, roadside bombings and IEDs, as well as, you know, massed attacks.
Yes.
Two quick questions. The first one might be quicker because it might be a false memory on my part. But wasn't there a guy from Minneapolis who was briefly prime minister of Somalia? And if that's the case, how did that happen? I heard it on NPR, I believe, just a few weeks ago, someone asking him about his experience.
Yeah, I think you're actually thinking of someone from New York as okay. opposed to Minneapolis.
You're Buffalo.
Yeah, he was from Buffalo. Actually, one of my friends, who's a professor of economics in Buffalo, also from the Somali diaspora, went and worked with him in the Somali government, something that briefly gave me hope that the TFG might be, the transitional federal government might be getting better, because I consider my friend to be, you know, just an excellent person. But yeah, I mean, you have a number of Somalis from the diaspora who've been tapped to serve within the transitional federal government. As to, you know, how it happened, I don't know of the internal machinations. There's something I suspect. I don't know that it's true. But what I suspect is that this was in part the result of Western pressure because of the corruption of the transitional federal government. Its writ has to constantly be renewed, and it's basically a client government. You know, if they didn't have foreign assistance, the government would collapse, and everyone who's a part of it would either be slaughtered or else would be driving a taxi cab in, you know, New York City or Minneapolis, St. Paul, or wherever. So as a result of that, I think that getting someone who'd been a diaspora member within the United States was seen as perhaps a way to clean up governance. Now, obviously, that doesn't quite follow, right? The fact that someone had lived in the United States doesn't mean that they know any, and served as a professor, doesn't mean that they know anything about governance. But I suspect that's how he ended up there. At any rate, his experience was not a pleasant one.
Oh. The other question, wasn't there just an international conference on Somalia? And I heard that on BBC News, and I don't think we've read too much about the repercussions or what happened.
Yeah, there was an international conference on Somalia, and indeed, we haven't heard much about it, in part because you've had a large number of international conferences looking at Somalia over the past few years. Now, some analysts recommend a different model. Like, historically, when you've had sort of peace initiatives in Somalia, they've tended to be at the bottom up. Somalia tends to be a very democratic society in terms of the way things go, in terms of standard interactions. So, for example, a clan leader can be challenged by, you know, an old woman or a young woman. And people are very outspoken in terms of their opinions. And the conferences have tended to be more at the top level, meaning there are people who are seen as being community leaders, but you don't necessarily have the buy-in of the community. I'm not certain that the bottom-up model is a model that is the solution, but it seems to be a little bit more credible to me, particularly in areas where you have greater stability, like in Somaliland. You know, you have two areas at the top of Somalia, Somaliland and Puntland, that are both quite a bit more stable and better governed than southern Somalia, which is what we know as just Somalia. In Somaliland, when you started to work out disputes there, They had much more of a bottom-up process. My guess is that the conference will, they probably ended up going to a nice hotel, good for them. And, you probably had, people talk face-to-face, which there could be some benefit to. But in the past, those haven't yielded great results, and I don't expect that from this one either.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
At the start of your talk, you talked about pirates very briefly, but my question would refer to piracy and how piracy is affecting American policy, and is there any connection to al-Shabaab?
I'll deal with the second one first, whether there's a connection to al-Shabaab. You have mixed reports on that. You've had a few intelligence services, including European intelligence services, weigh in and say that, yes, there is a connection. The argument against it is that the areas of overlap, with a few exceptions, aren't particularly great. That a lot of areas where the pirates are strongest are not Shabaab strongholds. What I can say is that there certainly is some overlap. The question really is the degree of overlap. And people who argue against the linkage will say that the overlap is basically one of coincidence. That in other words, Shabaab isn't executing piracy. In some places, they're taxing the pirates, but this isn't a Shabaab initiative. As to how it's affecting American policy, it's affecting not just our policy, but many countries' policy. In part because it's a very difficult problem set to deal with. I mean, you had for a while stepped up patrols in this area, one thing I'd hope to have is a PowerPoint, but I don't. But there's recently a map of where piracy has been over the past, say, 6 years. And you can see every year that they're extending out their reach further into places like the Indian Ocean, places that they traditionally haven't gone. And that's in part a response to increased capacity. They're very innovative, impressively so. And second, it's a response to the fact that there's patrols. And when there's a patrol, you end up moving somewhere else. There still isn't a great system for prosecuting pirates, which is problematic. Anyone who's basically when you come across a pirate, how do you know that they're a pirate? Most of them don't have peg legs. Most of them don't have eye patches. Very few have parrots, which makes profiling awfully difficult. They'll say, we're fishermen and we have all these guns because we're afraid pirates would attack us. But there's not a great system for prosecuting them. Ultimately, it's something that's helped to contribute, not like the prime contributor, but it's contributed to the rise in oil prices because this is a major choke point for the delivery of oil. And if you had a group like, say, Shabaab, using maritime capabilities offensively, say, now that they're affiliated with al-Qaeda, just launching attacks on tankers and downing several tankers rather than just capturing them, that's something that could have a major effect on commerce, and we certainly see the potential. Thus, this has produced within the maritime industry much greater discussion about how you end up protecting these passageways. In the past, boats have been unarmed for a variety of reasons, but you've tended to have unarmed vessels. There are questions about, for one thing, has been an increase in non-lethal armaments in vessels passing through. And there's a discussion about whether there should be more armed guards on board. You also have private companies emerging who will provide boats that essentially serve as guards to cargo that's going through this area.
Yes, George Cole Scott. You've given us a good rundown on a country we don't know much about. But we went into two wars to defeat al-Qaeda. And I wonder, since the death of bin Laden and others, where are they the strongest now, and how much danger are they to U.S. interests?
Thank you, sir. That's an excellent question. If I'm looking at where al-Qaeda is the strongest right now, I would say Yemen. But I'll step back for a second to give a little bit of a broader overview on that question, which is al-Qaeda, I think, is a very resilient organization in a way that our analysts are only beginning to understand. The way there's one very good thesis written at Fort Leavenworth by a then-major named Derek Jones, U.S. Army Special Forces. He's now a lieutenant colonel. But it's called the form, it's a mouthful, the form, function, and logic of clandestine cellular networks. Now, the key thing there is the term clandestine cellular networks. That's what Al-Qaeda is. It's a network that is both not visible to the, you know, it's not visible to the naked eye. It makes an effort to hide. And it's cellular, so that taking out a single node won't necessarily bleed over and destroy other nodes within the network. In other words, you take off out the head, like bin Laden, you take out a lieutenant, you know, a someone who directs external operations, and someone else will step up to replace them. This thesis by Derek Jones concludes that against such a foe, like just counter-network operations, that is, taking out each individual node, it's almost impossible to attain victory that way. A good example of this is Israel's war against Hamas, where it's utterly destroyed Hamas's leadership on previous occasions, and they ended up springing back up. So for Al-Qaeda, if we look back to, I'd say that this is not the greatest crisis, you know, bin Laden's death, that they've faced. I think the greatest crisis they've faced in the past 12 years was just after the 9/11 attacks, when they lost their safe haven in Afghanistan. Their leadership was almost destroyed at Tora Bora. Then they ended up escaping into Pakistan. When they did, they weren't firmly established in Pakistan. You know, they set about right away essentially embedding themselves into Pakistan's tribal structure. But at that time, you had this debate occur in the West, essentially a debate over whether Al-Qaeda was dead. You know, the question is Al-Qaeda more an idea than an organization? This was said a lot in 2002, 2003, 2004. And as we saw affiliates take the lead in operations in places like Chechnya, Indonesia, and the like, the view a lot of analysts had was, yes, Al-Qaeda is dead. Then in 2006, it definitively emerged that they were not, for two reasons. One is there was this major plot in Britain that it's called the Transatlantic Air Plot, a plot to blow up seven planes bound from the U.S. from Britain to the U.S. simultaneously using liquid explosives. This is the reason why now we can't carry more than like 3 ounces of liquid on board planes. And the second thing that happened that year is Al-Qaeda was able to definitively show videotape linking the central organization to a terrorist attack that occurred in Britain the previous year, a plot that detonated four bombs near simultaneously in Britain's mass transit, three in the subway, one on a bus. And at that point, the U.S. intelligence community did a 180 in its assessment from saying that Al-Qaeda, you know, the global jihadist movement was diffuse, lacked a definitive leadership, was growing more diffuse, to in 2006, 2007, their assessment was that it had protected or regenerated its homeland attack capability. Very significant shift in their thinking. Now, when we take that and look at it today, you're going to see that same debate, the debate about is Al-Qaeda dead? And you've already seen last year a number of analysts say definitively that Al-Qaeda is dead, based upon bin Laden's death as well as the Arab Spring. Now, I just got done reviewing 102 primary source statements from jihadists, from Sunni jihadists, within the first year of the Arab Spring, examining the question of what it does to the organization. I can say definitively that they are very optimistic about what the Arab Spring means for them. But you know, the fact that they're optimistic doesn't mean that they're right, of course. But I think that their perception does mean something in this equation. Their view is ultimately a longer-term view. Right now, I think they're focused on reestablishing operational security and regenerating ability to attack. Now, when we're talking about Al-Qaeda there, we're talking about one particular Al-Qaeda. That is the central leadership, which right now is in Pakistan and is definitively weakened. But you also have affiliates. Shabab is a strong affiliate. Another strong affiliate is Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen. Another is Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which is in northern Africa. And the affiliates all have individual capabilities that are quite strong. In about a two-year period, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was able to place three bombs on board passenger planes. Fortunately, you know, none of them killed anybody. Two were found after being flown on a couple of planes because Saudi intelligence had gotten a mole in on the plot. And the third one killed nobody because the unfortunate perpetrator of that attack blew up his own crotch but was unable to actually kill anybody besides, you know, that thing. So overall, I think that when we look at the organization, we need to keep in mind, A, the affiliates, and B, the potential for the core to regenerate. And I think that the core is looking for a repeat of the 2001 to 2006 period.
I'm going to ask you to back up before the 1500s and describe for us how and why the Somali people became Muslims.
That would go back to about, I don't know the exact dates. I'd place it, the time that it definitively happened would be by about the 12th century, the 1100s, although you had Islam start to go to the Horn of Africa previous to that. Unlike some other places, like, for example, if you look at the modern Middle East and Northern Africa, which had once been Christian and was conquered, Somalia's story is a little bit different. You had Arab traders who went to Somalia. You had more of a slow process of conversion rather than conquest within Somalia in terms of how Islam got there originally. Now, of course, it's not a history that lacks conquest. But the conquest that was actually most significant was the one perpetrated by Somalis against another group, well, two other groups. One is called the Zanj by Arab geographers at the time. The other is the Oromo people, which are a dominant ethnic group within Ethiopia. And the history of, and in part, the influx of Islam into this area, along with a few other things, like technology that was coming from the Arab areas, were able to both give the Somalis an impetus for expansion as well as the ability to do so. That's a bit of the history within Somalia. The one thing I should caveat is that the Somalis did not have a written language until the 20th century. So a lot of the early records we have through Arab historians and not through Somali primary source documents.
I heard you briefly talk about Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that we should suspend all aid to Pakistan, even though that some of the money that we supply to the government and military is being leaked into the Al-Qaeda and Taliban extremist groups?
Do I think we should... You said
suspend all aid to Pakistan?
Suspend it?
Yes.
That's a great question. I don't really... Like, we haven't had a Pakistan policy for a while. We've kind of... Pakistan... If you didn't have Pakistan supporting the insurgency in Afghanistan, it would look nothing like it does today. And there's kind of deep-seated historical reasons that I won't get into as to why Pakistan does what it does. But suspending aid to Pakistan is also has its dangers. In particular, A, we still, since we're in Afghanistan, rely upon Pakistan to move supplies through. Second, if you suspend aid, you end up losing leverage over them. On the one hand, it might be a good idea, but I wouldn't advocate it right now because you really have to think through what the second-order effects are going to be, and it would be an Armageddon in terms of our ability to get supplies through there. So you'd have to have an alternative supply route into Afghanistan immediately once you did this because that's exactly how Pakistan would retaliate. You cut off aid to us, they'll say, and you can no longer move your supplies through.
Okay. Thank you.
Last question.
Thank you. Good afternoon. David Cameron just recently said that the future of Somalia rests with the Somalis. Basically, it was almost in a tone of, throwing up my hands, whatever happens, happens. And my question from that statement is based on international funding, the transparency and accountability. And with the increase of UN peacekeepers from 12,000 to 17,000 just to secure funding. And I want to know what your thoughts are on the future use of international funds to help Somali out of whatever situation it finds itself in.
I think that in the future there will be international funds going to Somalia. And I think that probably one thing that was great for the Somali people in terms of the future of international funds is Shabaab officially joining Al-Qaeda, because it means that you're going to have a lot of countries who are very interested in Somalia. That's not necessarily good that's what it needs to get our attention. But I think that this announcement is something that's significant in terms of international funds going there. I think that let's divide it into a few different categories. There's military. Military funds are going to flow. The forces on the ground are basically going to be AMISOM forces. I think that you may see other countries beyond Uganda and Burundi actually providing troops there. You have a number of countries who've made a lot of noise about providing troops, but so far you only have those two who've come through. We may see other countries actually ponying up and providing troops, particularly if you have Shabab actually meddling outside of Somalia. In that area, I think that they're pretty that funds will flow that way. The second one is humanitarian funds, which I think will continue to flow. The major obstacle there will be, number one, security. That you know, if people don't have enough security on the ground, you won't have the people actually providing humanitarian aid. And you know, if humanitarian aid is being provided to Somalia, but the aid workers are, say, located in Ethiopia, that provides a real limitation to your ability to provide aid. You know, some of it can flow through the government, but you know, you have another problem there, which is that it's basically the government of Mogadishu. You may see alternative aid models emerge where they start to have the aid flow through clan leadership or flow through alternative governing structures like Ahl al-Sunnah wal Jama'ah. That's, I think, a possibility because I think more and more people are going to have to come to grips with the fact that Somalia is a state without a government and so figure out what to do in that unique situation. But you know, you'll have it, but as long as you don't have good delivery mechanisms and also as long as Shabab is basically you know, limiting the ability of aid workers to work in its areas, the Shabab areas in particular are going to be hammered from humanitarian grounds. The third thing is political funding, like funding to set up a government. And that's the thing which I think is most threatened because basically Western countries quite reasonably have no you know, no confidence at all in Somalia's government. I think that until a more reliable government or a better governing model emerges, that's going to be the area that's threatened. And I actually don't see that as being particularly problematic. In fact, you know, basically revoking funding for the government and forcing a new government is something which, while I was skeptical of this you know, a year ago, I see as being more and more realistic, essentially allowing its writ to expire and you know, forcing them to create something new from scratch on the assumption that this has failed. It wouldn't change a whole lot. I mean, all it would mean is that you know, those few blocks of Mogadishu that are controlled by you know, the transitional federal government would suddenly have no one in control. And you know, I think, frankly, those few blocks could survive until a new government is constituted. Essentially, you know, Somalia is a very difficult case. It's a very sad story when we look at what's happened there. And it's one where, you know, I mean, I as an American, I don't think we should be in the habit of kicking ourselves for things, but it's an area where clearly our policies could have been a lot better. I think that the major thing is learning the lessons that we can learn from Somalia and both doing the best that we can to try to manage the situation there, but understanding that future Somalias are likely to arise. Government capacity is going to decline in many parts of the world. Non-state actors are becoming more powerful at the same time. And you know, as Thomas Hobbes outlines, sometimes the greatest threat we can face in terms of you know, individual liberty, in terms of just ability to lead a prosperous life, comes when you have no government, and instead a situation of anarchy prevails. This is something we're going to have to manage moving forward. So in conclusion, sorry, you know, I'm always the bearer of bad news wherever I go, but for some reason I keep getting invited back. But I wanted to thank you all. You've been a tremendous audience, and I'll be around for a while if any of you want to chat about anything.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a speech by David Gartenstein Ross on the subject of Somalia, America's Forgotten Battleground. His speech to the World Affairs Council of Greater Richmond was recorded on February 29th. The views expressed on WCVE Forum are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the management and staff of WCVE Public Radio.